Good afternoon. Good afternoon. I think this might, yes, okay. So, last time, we talked a bit about automation for building programs. And one topic we started with was about libraries, so kind of the idea that we can, you know, package a bunch of stuff, functions and things like that together as a piece of code you can use in multiple pieces of software. And we said there were kind of two ways that these libraries work. We have these static libraries, which become part of the executable when you make the executable. So it's kind of like, you know, if you had the object files in your program, but you'll get them from some other location and they'll be put in your executable when you make it. We have these dynamic libraries, which were sort of also known as shared libraries, same thing for our purposes, which were loaded when the executable started. So these would not become part of your executable. There would be code run in your executable or somewhere else that would open up the file with the actual code for this library and load it into memory, and your executable program would call that loaded code. So then we talked about automating building. And we were looking at a program called Make, which I said was kind of the oldest build system people still commonly use. And the big thing it's automating is knowing we have to build some file based on other files, it figures out when do I want to run the commands to build that file. So we have these rules where we specify what we're creating, the things we're creating it from, and the command to run, and Make will basically run those commands based on the prerequisites, the things it depends on that you specify, and the modification times. It will use the prerequisites to not only determine what to commands to run, but the order to run them in. And this way, we can just edit a few files, run a make command, and make will do all the things that need to happen based on the edits we did, assuming we set up our make file correctly. We also mentioned, well, kind of this just target prereqs commands. If we just follow that's we can do that for a large project, but there's a lot of redundancy in that. For example, our commands generally contain things that are also in our prereqs and our targets, and we're typing things multiple times. That gives us lots of opportunities for errors, you know, not having the things quite match up. And often, like, if we have rules like build a.o file, that's probably going to be the same for everything in our entire project. If we have like 100 C files, that's a lot of stuff in our make file that isn't really, you know, well, is basically should be redundant. And there are kind of mechanisms to help us out with that. So we've learned about variables and macros. So we can, for example, have one place in our file where we set, you know, what flags we're passing to the compiler and just use that in multiple places. We can have these pattern rules, so we can write one rule saying, rather than build foo.o from foo.c, we can say build anything.o from the same thing.c, and just write that once. And we also mentioned that there are built-in rules, because, well, we kind of know how you're always building .o files from .c files, and Make, in fact, has that built in, so you don't have to write it every time. And you can just change some variables to set exactly what that, the details of what that rule is doing. So questions about things we covered last time? Okay, seeing any? So I'd like to go over one thing that I probably should have mentioned when I talked about libraries, but came up a little in the lab. When looking at libraries, you should usually put the library link on the line to make your executable last, or all the libraries last, basically. And the reason for this is, by default, at least some linkers, I probably should expect, you know, at least some linkers, probably not all of them, process files they're given in order. And when they see a library, what they do is they look at what functions do the things that I've seen before this on the command line need, and they only will use that part of the library if they can. This mostly affects static libraries. It usually doesn't affect dynamic libraries because they work differently as far as what the linker is actually doing when it makes the executable. But this is something where you can, you know, you have a library on the line and it doesn't look like it's worked, sometimes this is why. Because the linker is just not looking for the function because of where you specify the library on the command line. So questions on ordering? Okay. Yes, sorry. Question, how does this interact with the dash capital L modifier? So the dash capital L specifies a path. So if I don't use dash capital L, basically this is going to check sort of a bunch of standard locations for something called libname.a or libname.so. And these will usually be, you know, usually be sysadmin control locations. And if your library's there, you don't need a dash capital L option. But if your library's not in one of these locations, you know, if library is elsewhere, you can use dash L path, and then we'll look at path slash lib name dot a and path slash lib name dot so. So use capital L when your library is not one of these sort of standard system administrator library installing locations. Does that answer your question? Yeah. So the question is, does the name I have here correspond with the name of the library we're using? Versus, because you're seeing in my examples, I have libname.a and so on. So the compiler, sorry, the linker is going to take this name and it's going to add that lib and .a and that lib and .so to it. So this is, you know, this is going to expand to some prefix slash lib name dot a or dot so, where prefix is one of those system directories or a directory you specify with capital L, and dot a or dot so on Linux, on other systems there might be different extensions, and some other and different rules as far as the lib part. Does that answer your question?
Yes, thank you.
Okay, other questions? Okay, so one piece of logistics. So we're gonna have a quiz basically weekly in this class. The first one's released this evening. It's currently set at 9, so after this lecture, I have time to adjust the quiz for anything I don't get to, and actually have TAs hopefully check any changes I make. It's due 15 minutes before lecture on Tuesday. What we do, and it's mostly auto-graded, but we're going to read comments and work on it. We'll have TAs do that, obviously not automatically, so that's going to take some time for that to appear, and we'll just this automatically given scores over about a week from when the quiz is due. If you think there's info missing on the quiz or there's an error in the quiz, that's what the comments and work is for, one of the things it's for. We generally will not be able to give clarifications. The main reason for this is that if I give a clarification on Saturday, that's not very nice to people who had planned around, oh, I can do the quiz on Friday and not have to worry because I have like lots of classes on Monday and stuff on the weekend. I don't want to tell those people, sorry, you don't get the clarifications. I don't think that's very nice. I'll show the quiz system later. The quiz system doesn't have a submit button. Instead, around the answer is the box around the question. It will turn green when it's submitted. It will be yellow or red if it is not submitted. And it should be submitted automatically when you press a button or when you click out of a text box. Answers are recorded when they turn green. If they don't turn green, probably there's an issue like you're not actually logged into NetBadge, your Wi-Fi doesn't work, or something's wrong on our end, and your answer is not recorded. There is no time limit. and you don't need to take it in one sitting. You can go back and reopen it anytime up to the deadline and change your answers, and we will use the last thing you submitted. And I will switch to demo. Okay, so to deal with this being on the other monitor, and where my cursor is, so that should be there, and this should be there. Okay, so so for a quiz, you can open it up, you'll get a confirmation, do you really want to open it, because we record that you open it. And you'll have questions that can look like this. So we'll have like multiple choice questions, multiple select all that apply, single choice, and short answer questions. When you click a button, you see that the box flashes yellow and then turns green. If it turns green, the answer is recorded. If you go away from the page, it's still gonna be there. And so on. You can write some comments. So I think this question can't be answered because, and we'll have someone read them and they'll be recorded when you click outside that text box or otherwise focus outside it. And you can see the box turn green for that. And the same for elsewhere. So that's taking the quiz, and you can go back to this later. So I can be here and I can open it up later, and my answer should still be there for me to change if I want to, up until the deadline. Yes, question?
So there's no file submit button, it's just whoever the deadline is, your current selected answers will be what's submitted?
So question, there's no submit button, whatever's your current answers are at the deadline will be what's submitted? Yes. Yes. The question is, you get automatic feedback as soon as the line closes? Yes. So that's the other part of the deck. If I can find my mouse. Thank you very much. There it is. See here, you can see what you might see after the deadline. So you can see the answers that are correct in the key are marked. There's a place to make a regrade request. If I wrote some comments, there might be some responses to the comments that, depending on what the grader did, or an adjustment to the grade. Obviously, this won't appear immediately because we won't look at your comments until after the quiz is due, and it's going to be done by a bunch of TAs who probably are going to be working not so much on Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, given typical TA schedules in my experience. So you'll eventually get responses to any comments you had, and you can submit regrade requests here, or you can email me about them. And we will try to take comments and any work you show and so on into account within about a week of the quiz being due. Obviously, the automated part will not do that. So questions about quiz logistics? Yes? What are the 60s and 80s? So for multiple choice questions, we will show how many students selected that each answer. Which is useful for me to know if I should probably go over a question in lecture, and might be useful for you to know if a question was hard or confusing. Yes?
Really low rate of students answering the question correctly will not necessarily occur if that question be removed.
Question, if there's a really low rate of students answering the question correctly, will that question be removed? That is not the criteria I use for adjusting questions. I have occasionally dropped or accepted additional answers based on an impression that the question was incorrect, had an error in it, or had multiple interpretations. So that might happen, but I'm not going to do it based on the question was too hard only. It's going to be like the question could be read in three different ways or something like that. Does that answer your question? So it's in the quiz, and the quiz is linked off Canvas on the side or off the main web page at the top. And the first one is due next Tuesday before lecture. Okay, so that's on the quiz. So let's go to our sort of finishing up building. So one thing, even with sort of our work for avoiding redundancy in makefiles, you may have noticed is that part of makefiles for C programs seemed actually pretty error-prone, which is that we kind of need to specify all the .h dependencies. And that can be automated, right? You know, the compiler figures out what .h files are needed. And in fact, GCC and Clang have an option to output make rules that include the .h files that you can add to a make file. And there's multiple different ways of sort of making this be automatically used by make that you might see if you look at sort of projects that you see make files out there. Also, there's a bunch of programs that generate makefiles. So sometimes rather than writing makefiles by hand, people will write a program to write a makefile. And that's probably the most common use of make today, is that someone will use make through a makefile generator for a large software project. And besides those, there are also other build systems out there. So there's lots of other build systems. We're focusing on make because it's old and common, and because, well, the other build systems are basically doing something very similar. They might be more specialized, like, you know, maybe they have like code to handle how Java gets compiled that make obviously wouldn't have, since make only runs commands that you specify, and things like that. But they're essentially doing the same thing make does of sort of having these rules and looking at modification times to decide what to do. Questions? That's where I'm going to finish up on build systems. And we're going to get to our main topic, which is about this. And we'll ignore, I should have removed this part from the slide later, but the question is, how does OS decide? The OS decide if this is okay. Is this okay? If I run this, probably it should work. If you run this, probably it shouldn't. Right. So how do we enforce this in the OS? So we'll talk more about, I guess, the stuff I have here later on about what sort of is going on as far as detailed steps. But we're first going to focus on the question of how do we set the policy about whether the OS allows me to access this file or not? So we're going to look at that. And we need some extra information to do this. So, hi. Interesting. That is, I do not know what, I see what's happening. Maybe. Right. What's that? This is here and also still not working. Do I just not have a, that's there and there. And why? Great. Okay. So let's see if love my presentation program breaking in the middle of things. Okay. So So we need to decide whether you can open a file. So that's what the decision we're making. Can we open this? Last question, you know, how to know if this is okay? And we're going to need some extra data to do that. So you might have some ideas. Well, we could figure out whether this is okay based on the arguments that are actually made supplied to the system. But the problem is we sort of can't trust, you know, a program to say it can or can't access the file. Right, we can't trust the program to give us that information. So you might imagine a solution where, oh, when we call open, the standard library like checks if that's okay. That's not going to work out because we can use whatever libraries we want when we make our executable. And you might say, oh, we can use where the code is calling it's from. That also doesn't work because, you know, we want something to be different if I run, say, you know, Vim or Nano versus, you know, a student runs Vim or Nano. So that's the same program, same code, but depending on who runs it, we want different behavior. So we can't just look at what program's doing it, is it my program? That's not what's gonna happen. So we need something else to tell us. And so we're gonna have to track some information about sort of who's running the program. And the most common way that we're gonna do this is with what we'll call a user ID. And this is how OSs identify who a process belongs to. And I don't think we've seen the word process. We'll learn more later on about what a process is, but a process is an instance of a running program. So if I have three terminals open and I type ls in all three of them, I have three processes that are ls. And if you type ls in yours, you have another process that's ls. So you can have multiple instances of the same program running. Each one is going to be a process. And for each process, the OS is going to track a user ID. And it's going to use that to decide, can you open that file or not? So questions on processes and, you know, having IDs associated with them. Okay, so on Unix, yes, sorry, I should look more carefully. So the question is, how do we assign what the user can do to the user ID? We're gonna talk about a couple strategies for that in a bit. There are multiple ways that can be done. We're gonna talk about one strategy, which is basically there's gonna be information associated with files to tell us what user IDs can access it. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Yeah. Can one user ID have many processes at the same time? Yes. So we can have one process that we can have many processes, each of which are associated with the same user ID, and that's very common. So on Unix-like systems, POSIX is the sort of standard for Unix. You can get the user ID of your program with the get EUID function. Let's say, what's the E? The E stands for effective. So it turns out that Unix-like systems often track multiple user IDs for a program. For some corner cases, we're mostly not gonna cover. And it returns this UIDT. And on Unix, this is just an integer. And you might say, wait a moment, when I log into Portal, I log in with my computing ID, which is a string. It turns out that the decision Unix has made is that kind of the core part of the OS, which we'll learn is called the kernel, the part that's always loaded and the part that's actually making the decisions when you open a file, can you access it, doesn't know about your user names. It just has these numbers, just to keep things simpler for that core part. So you might say, wait a moment, if I'm logging in with a name, how does that work? And sort of the standard library and the programs that come with the system are going to keep track of a mapping from names to numbers. But sort of the actual decisions on the system are going to be made just using these numbers. And there's basically a database that's maintained by the system administrator, sort of a sysadmin database has this mapping that those standard programs use. So these user IDs, this is kind of the minimum we need to kind of restrict what programs can do based on sort of our ideally who's running them. It turns out that in practice, this is kind of like maybe not really enough. One thing that comes up a lot is that we might want a whole class of users to be do some things. Like we might want all instructors to be able to access a folder. So to do that, Unix systems track some additional IDs with a process that aren't user IDs. And these are called groups. And like user IDs, group IDs, groups are identified by numbers. So we have group IDs that are numbers. And it turns out that we have multiple groups that are associated with the process. We have an effective group ID, which is what sort of Unix originally started with, is that every process had a user and a group associated with it. And then we realized, wait a moment, well, like, we could have as a user that should be part of instructors and part of, you know, a particular courses group. You know, we can't handle that with just one group, so they supported having a list of extra groups that they added on later. And this is also going to be tracked by the core part of the OS. Just basically the user ID and a list of group numbers, and they're going to check it every time we say try to open files and things like that. Yeah?
What's the point of having group IDs again?
The idea is that we're often going to want to give permissions not to particular users, but a whole class of users. And group IDs are a way to do that. Another option that's maybe like less viable is that we can also like have we can have a program run with a particular group and not have all the users programs run with that group. So we can give one or two processes extra access by giving it a group ID that most programs of that user do not have. Yes, back there.
How would you distinguish a group ID from a user ID?
How would you distinguish a group ID from a user ID? So you have to know it's a group ID or it's a user ID. There's nothing inherently that tells you which is which. So if it comes from get groups, it's a group ID. If it comes from get UID, it's a user ID, for example. Other questions? Yeah.
So does each process have its own user ID? So for example, if on my computer, like, I use your Arduino, does each process have its own user ID for me? Or is there just like one user ID that's just given to each process?
Question, does each process have its own user ID? Or is there one user ID that's assigned to all processes? Each process generally has its own user ID. And this is because most OSs we're used to support having multiple users use them at the same time. So this is obvious for machines like Portal that you can log into, but it turns out that kind of the OSs that you're using even on sort of single user machines usually also support this notion as well. Other questions? Yeah?
What is POSIX stands for?
What does POSIX stand for? POSIX is the Portable Operating System Interface Standard. And I think the X is part of interface somehow or something. I don't remember the details. But basically, it's the sort of standard Unix. So everything that calls itself Unix or Unix-like probably tries to follow this document that is published called POSIX. And you can find a copy of that online. It's published by the Open Group. They have a copy of the whole thing that these OSs are supposed to follow. Yes?
So as far as process that owns both, is effectively a user ID that has the authority and an extra group ID that's also
question, which ID would be checked first? We'll probably get to that when we talk about the specifics of how we specify who can access a file and things like that. Because it's going to depend on those specifics.
But you only need one
of the IDs. Question is, I can have access to a file based on just my user ID, just my group ID? Yes, that is often the case. Like, most systems do not enforce this as kind of any one of these will give you access, not you need a combination, though that's not required, and you could imagine exceptions to that. Yes, back there. What's the purpose of get groups and what are extra group IDs? Maybe I can give an illustration. So on a department machine, Power 4 is kind of like Portal, but older. There's a command called ID you can run. You can also run this on Portal. And it will print out what its IDs are. So here we see that it has user ID. This is from get UID, the 858182. And when it looked it up in the database, that was my computing ID, CR4BD. My primary group ID, the one from getEGID, was 21 for CS faculty, but when we called getGroups, we got this whole list, which included a bunch of other groups that also make sense for me to be a part of. So probably, if POSIX were being designed from scratch, only getGroups would exist, but basically what happened is that they initially said, oh, we only need one group, and they realized that kind of was a mistake. But they have to still be compatible with all the software that assume you could only have one group. Yes? Question, listener groups is all the groups that the user ID of that process is a part of. It's all the groups that the process is a part of. Typically, this is going to be set when I log in, so it will be the same ones that I'm a part of, but we can technically manipulate it on a per process basis if we have the right access. Does that answer your question? Yeah.
So does that mean that the header on the other slide is incorrect because it says that it returns an int when you put in an input size and you're providing?
Question, how does this get group functions return the list of groups if it's returning an int? That's your question basically. And the answer is that this is a funny syntax that's equivalent to GID a pointer to a GIDT, so it expects you to give it an array, and it fills in that array. The int it returns is telling you if there was an error. Yeah? So the kernel doesn't know. Question is, on the slide I say the kernel only knows the numbers, so the kernel doesn't know about the database. That's right. So the kernel is written so it doesn't care how the mapping from numbers to names works. So you can, in fact, we really do change how that works between systems. So for example, on my laptop, the way that mapping works is that there's a file that's restricted to the system administrator that contains that mapping. On Portal, the way that mapping works is that there's a server the RIT staff runs that maintains that mapping. And the standard library has different code to handle those two cases. Does that answer your question? Okay, back there.
Does that mean that the ID command isn't just a kernel process because it gives you both user ID and the name?
Question, does that mean the ID command is not just a kernel process? Yes, this is a program you could write, right? So this is basically just a program that's calling these functions and also calling the functions in the standard library that look up IDs and return names. Does that answer your question?
Yes.
Other questions? I thought I saw something over here, but. Okay. So you can see here that typically it looks like groups correspond to sort of what I am. We can have groups that correspond to things that aren't directly related to the user. So for example, something you might do on a system is you might configure it so when I SSH in, I'm part of one set of groups, but when I log in person, I'm part of maybe an additional group, like a video group, to have access to the monitor that normal users don't have. So this is something that seems useful. It's kind of more dubious whether this actually works out. The big problem is that like I can keep something running after I log in person, And unless you do a lot of extra work, that thing is still going to have in its list of groups the video group. So even though I've logged out, I have a program that never exited, it still has access to the monitor unless you take some countermeasures to prevent that, like finding all my programs and making sure they get killed when I exit the in-person login. Okay, some questions? Yeah. Is it not possible to remove groups once a program is already running? POSIX does not provide a way to do this. It's probably possible to do it in ways that are much less portable. Okay. Other questions? Yeah.
So you said we can actually write the mappy function, like the map the screen to the IDs.
So question, I said you can write this sort of thing that maps the IDs to names. I wouldn't say it's in the standard library, so it's like, it's a header file that's, you know, like printf, like there's a function for this that you can call. If I remember correctly, the function is I don't remember the name of the function. There's a function basically that takes a ID and looks up a name that you can call in the standard library. Question, if you have the idea of any username, you can't do something bad, you know, bad with that. That's right, because note that here, I've given you a way to get your IDs. There's no set function that I've shown you. And the reason why is that, well, there is a set function, but it only works if you're the system administrator. So you as a normal user, you know, even if you know the ID you want to be, you can't do anything useful with that, because you're not going to have permission to change your program to have that ID. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Yeah.
Could you explain the concept that some groups don't always correspond?
Can I explain the concept that some groups don't correspond to users? So my example here is that if I'm logging to a machine in person, yeah, you might want me to have access to do things with a monitor that most users don't have. A way we could do this is we could make it so the programs that I run from logging in person are part of a video group, but when I SSH in, the programs I run are not part of a video group.
Oh, okay, so.
And we can do similar things for other things where we want to kind of give some of the things a user runs access, but not all of them.
Okay, so it wouldn't really tie to your, so when you log in, when you log in person, you would have the operating system would like give you a user ID and it would give you like a group ID, and if you SSH in, it will just give you a user ID.
So question, in this scenario, when I log in person, the operating system would give me a user ID and a group ID. When I SSH in, it would just give me a user ID. So what, so probably when you log in person or SSH in, it will give you a user ID and a set of group IDs, but that set can change.
Okay.
And I would think it's fair to say that what's doing that is part of the operating system, but the way this works in practice is that it's actually a program that's just running as a system administrator user.
Okay.
So it has access to change user IDs, and that program can just have code to decide what groups to set.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Other questions? Okay. So we talked about tracking user and group IDs. How do we use that? And there are going to be two mechanisms we'll talk about. And they're both forms of what we'll call access control lists. So access control is who can you access something. And it's a list. So it's a list specifying who can access something. And POSIX has a very restricted access control list. We'll find out that there's a more less restricted version of this too, but there's a very restricted version, you know, that works on all Unix, works on any Unix-like system. And in this scheme, each file has associated with it a user ID called the owner, and 3 bits indicating whether that user ID is allowed to read, to write, or execute the file. a group ID and 3 bits, indicating whether members of that group ID are allowed to read, write, or execute the file, and 3 more bits, indicating whether someone who's not one of those users or groups is allowed to read, write, or execute the file. And this applies to all files, and on Unix, directories are files, just a different kind of file. And you might say, what is the execute bit to run directories? It means search, meaning access files in the directory if you know their name. So read on directories is get a list of the directory, but you can access things in a directory that you can't list if you know the name of them, if you have search, aka execute permission. And a special thing about this is that we need to say who has permissions to change all these bits of permission. Change permission, I should say the bits here. That is, the owner has permission and the system administrator, as we'll learn later. Yes?
How are those bits expressed? Are they just one bit successful
and 0? How are those bits expressed? That is our next slide. So typically they're 1 if it's accessible, 0 if it's not, and typically this is written as a 3-bit base 8 number. We'll talk about that a bit in a second. Yes?
For the 1 user ID plus /\ bits per user, would it be that you have the 1 user ID that has access, they can change permissions, and then you would have a list of users and then also a group ID with users in that, or would it be that all user IDs for various actions like reading, writing, those would all be under the group ID?
So the question is, can I have sort of multiple users listed, or is that all in the group ID?
Yeah.
In this scheme, that's all in the group ID. And if you want multiple groups, too bad. If you want multiple users, too bad. So we'll see that there's a more flexible scheme that just isn't implemented everywhere that supports the obvious extension of why can't we just list a whole bunch of users and a whole bunch of groups? And it does that in kind of the obvious way of just rather than just specifying one, we can specify as many as we like, and the same for the groups. But this is kind of the baseline. This is sort of what the oldest version of this, and the one that is way more portable than the sort of more extendable version we'll show in a minute. Other questions? Yeah?
So only one user ID and only one group ID has the ability to change permissions for both users.
Question, only one user ID and one group ID has the ability to change permissions? It's more restricted than that. Only one user ID has the ability to change the permission bits.
Okay.
And that user can probably also change the group ID. They can't change the user ID usually.
Okay.
Yeah.
Are there separate group IDs for read versus
write? Are there separate group IDs for read versus write? Nope, just one. And you have to specify whether they can read, write, or execute, or any combination. Other questions? Yeah?
So you're talking about reading the octal number, is that the same thing as chmod that changes?
Question, is the 3-bit octal number the same thing as chmod? This is exactly chmod, we'll talk about that in a second. Yes?
You said the group only has the 1 bit. Is that the 3?
What?
You mentioned that the group ID only has the 1 bit.
This question, I mentioned the group ID has only 1 bit. There's only 1 group ID, and they have these 3 bits. And there was a question behind you, yes? Yes, so the default setting is anyone else. This, in fact, is sometimes called other. So which maybe is more intuitive. So as I alluded to, these permissions are typically, often you'll see these encoded in a 9-bit number, which is written in octal, which used to be way more popular than it is today. So octal is base 8. And that's handy here because since each octal digit is 3 bits, the first digit is our user permissions, the second digit is our group permissions, and the last digit is our other, everyone else permissions. And we use 4 for read, 2 for write, 1 for execute. We add or them together. So for example, 700 says user, read, write, execute, group, nothing, other, nothing. or 451 says user read, group read and execute, other, oh, not none, execute. Questions about this encoding? Yeah?
Does that mean we're limited in the number of users that we have
in the system?
Questions,
that mean we're limited to the number of user groups we have in the system? This is a separate setting from the user and group IDs. So this is only setting the read, write, and execute. The, how we set the user and group IDs is completely independent of this, so there's not a limitation like that. Other, so someone, yes, back there. Sorry.
So when a user changes the host permissions on the file, like, they never just have to innovate all of the, like, their root access, thread access, and exit access, does that mean they no longer change?
The question is, if I change my permissions on a file, so for example, let's say I change my permissions to something where, like 077, where I have no access to the file, no read, write, or execute access, can I still change the permissions? Yes. So the owner always is allowed to change the permissions. But if you deny yourself read, write, and execute permissions, that means when you open or execute the file, you get an error message. Yes. Question, only the user can change the permissions of the file, only the user and like the system administrator. Does that answer your question? Okay, other questions? Okay, so someone mentioned chmod, and you often will see these bits exposed through the chmod command, or change mode. These are sometimes called the mode bits, partly because there's some extra bits that we aren't seeing here before here that we usually won't be changing that are related to what kind of file it is. So you can say chmod 700, or chmod 475, and wow, do it. You can also use a syntax that I would probably find more intuitive of specifying user equals combination of rewrite or execute and others and groups equals some combination of that as another way of expressing that that you might find more intuitive. That's actually technically less portable, but it works on the versions of chmod you're likely to see on Linux, and I think it's worth not being confused about what you're doing if you change the permissions to access a file. So questions about these commands? Yeah?
So since you're explicitly like saying you need to be able to order, doesn't necessarily matter?
Question, the order doesn't matter? Yes. In the second syntax, the order doesn't matter. You can do it in whatever order. The chmod command also supports specifying changes to permissions. So I can do, say, u plus rx. We'll say, take the current permissions, and to the user part of it, add, read, and execute if they're not there. And we can do similar things of removing permissions if they're there, but keeping everything else the same and combinations of that. Yes? So the question is, this is more flexible than using the octal bits. This is all stuff you could do using the octal bits, but in this case, it's exactly something you could do using the octal bits. In this case, to do this using the octal command, you need to figure out what are the current settings, how do I change them to add RNX to the user part, what's the octal for that, and write that by hand, right? So like if the permissions were right now were 1, 3, 5, you need to look up, oh, they're 1, 3, 5 now, to add user read and execute. That's 4 and 5, 4 and 1. One's already there, and realize, oh, I want to run chmod 535 foo. So you could do it by hand. It's just extra work. That answer your question? Other questions? Okay, so this is chmod permission. So I've shown changing the permission bits. You can also, in a limited fashion, change the group ID with the command is chgroup. And the system administrator can change the owner, but you probably can't. But you saw that this is kind of inflexible, that if you don't have a group that matches what you want to do, like who you want to have access to the file, you can't do that. So like if I wanted to share stuff with my partners in a class, probably the system administrators haven't created a group for us to use. So I can't use the group permissions to do that. I don't want to give everyone access to our files. And that's kind of tedious. You know, kind of hard. And if we had to have a group created for everything, that would be like lots and lots of groups. Kind of doesn't really scale. So there's kind of an alternate idea, which is that, well, we have this kind of very restricted access control list here, right? This is access, a list of who can access the file, but it only has 3 slots, basically. And they're very limited in what they can make. But we can extend this to say, well, let's just allow a whole bunch of things. And there are sort of more general access control lists, and these are relatively common. So there's on Windows, NTFS, and I think later file systems support this general access control list. And there's a version that was standardized by POSIX, so standardized by the Unix people, and is supported on our live machine sometimes, but not everywhere. Where rather than having a list of one user ID, one group ID, and so on, we can have sort of as many as we like. Not really as many as we like, but a large enough number that we're not going to care. So we're going to talk about the POSIX version because we're going to use that in a lab next week. So it turns out it's supported on some parts, some directories on Portal will support this sort of general access control list. And we can sort of specify these lines. It looks kind of like a configuration file. You can have lines specifying, oh, groups get, you know, the group students has read and execute but not write. The group faculty has read, write, and execute. This user has read, write, and execute. This user has no permissions, even if they would have permission from the group's settings. So we can specify basically an arbitrary list of users and groups and whether they can rewrite or execute a file or directory in this scheme. Yes?
Say like you put user TJLA at the very top, would it still like, and then let's say TJLA was in like the group students, would TJLA then get like the read and write, or does user always override?
So question, does user always override group, or does the order matter? In the POSIX scheme, the user always overrides group, and the order basically doesn't matter. This is not true on sort of all versions of this. So I think Windows might be different, for example. Yes?
How would you specify like, the default permissions?
How would you specify the default? I think it's, I can look this up quickly. Yeah, it's going to be other and double colon. You know, so, you know, if you wanted to give everyone read, you'd have a line like other colon colon r slash slash. Yes? Question, is this more flexible than access control? So first of all, these are both access control lists. So this is just a more flexible version of kind of the standard Unix permissions, right? We've just added features to the standard Unix permissions. the question about processes having multiple user IDs. So this is associated with a file. So I'm saying a file or directory. So I'm saying who can access the file or directory. And when we're matching this against processes, the process is still going to be running as one user, and it's just going to be and some small number of groups, and we're going to match those users and groups versus these lines here. So basically, if my process is running as MST3K, it will match this line. If it's running as someone in the students group, it will match this line. If it's running, sorry, it's running with the students group, it will match this line. If it's running with the faculty group, it will match this line, and so on. Question, does flexible mean user control? So whoever's setting the permissions, which is usually the person who created the file, has more control over who can access it in this scheme. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, I was saying user control.
So,
does the word flexible means that the access control lists are looser, like less restrictive?
Oh, does the word flexible mean the access control lists are less restrictive? No. They're more specific, and that could be less or more restrictive, depending on how they're set up. Yes?
How is this implemented in NTFS?
And how is this implemented in NTFS? It is, I don't know the details, but there is a similar way of setting basically a list of users and groups and defaults, and what operations they can do, I believe, on NTFS. The list of things you can specify is not just rewrite, execute, there's a little bit longer of a list of operations you can control. Yeah. Yes?
Just a clarifying question. If a user has no access with the group, like a user is like associated with has access, does the user still not have access?
So the question is, if a user has no access, but a group they're associated with has access, do they still have no access? In the POSIX scheme, yes. Not all OSs will work this way. If the user explicitly has no access, I should say. Unlisted users will have access. Other questions? Yeah?
What if they try to make a two-line requirement for the same user ID?
Question, what happens if we have multiple lines for the same user ID? I don't know. Probably you shouldn't do that. Yeah? So the question is, how does the OS know which user created the file and therefore can manage this? So that would be the owner information in that sort of restricted access control list that is more portable. So this is kind of an extension to that limited access control list I showed you earlier and kind of exists alongside it. Other questions? Okay, and as for manipulating this, there's commands to get the access control list, to set it, or to change it in various ways. We're going to use this in the lab next week. I mentioned earlier that, the core part of the OS doesn't know user IDs, so one of the things these commands are doing, or they're converting the user and group names into IDs at some point, so that core part of the OS can actually use this list. Questions? Okay, so. So there's, on Unix-like systems, there's a special user, which is user ID 0. And this is sometimes called super user or root. And most non-Unix systems have an equivalent of this, sometimes like called administrator or system. And basically, for these people, when they make requests of the OS, sort of system calls, which we'll say are sort of requests of the privileged part of the OS, of the core OS, we'll talk more about what that means later, they only work for this user ID 0. So for example, on a Unix system, on a typical Linux system, if I want to shut down, that's just something that's hard-coded in the OS that if your program is user ID 0, you can do this. Otherwise, it's just not going to work. And also, these generally pass sort of all permission checks. So if a program running with user ID are asked to open a file, typical Unix system will just ignore all those access control lists, just say, yep, you're good. Doesn't matter if you're on the list or not. So we're going to talk, as kind of our next topic, about something called kernel mode. And there's often confusion with this idea of a user ID that's treated specially by the system and kernel mode, which is, we're going to learn, is the mode the processor is in when the OS, the core part of the OS is running, where the processor will let the OS do whatever it wants. When your program is running, it's running what's called user mode, and it's not allowed to do anything. And the super user sort of doesn't change that relationship. A program running as root doesn't actually have direct access to the system. It just gets to make requests to the OS, and the OS is programmed to say yes. But it still needs to go through the OS to do anything to the system. It isn't able to directly manipulate everything. So if we have this special user ID, you might say, well, you know, do we really need this? And it turns out that we use this not just for like people doing system administrator stuff, but this comes up all the time in our normal use of a system. There's actually lots of programs that run with this user ID 0 on a typical Unix-like system. And one reason is that if we're logging in, you know, we log in, type in my user ID and a password, and gonna get a prompt. And you might say, how does that work? And it turns out that this is just a normal program doing this. This is not something special in the OS handling this. There's just a program which takes as input a user ID and a name and figures out whether or not to allow that, and then starts a shell as that user. And this means it's doing some operations that we don't want to allow normal users to do, right? We don't want everyone to be able to check, is this my professor's password? We only want some programs to do that. We don't want anyone to be able to change the user ID a program is running as, and so on. So the reason that this program can work is that it's running as that super user, as that user ID 0, because, and you know, the system administrator set it up so at boot it would run that way. And because it's running as user ID 0, it can do these things that we don't want normal programs to do, but we don't have to have the core part of our OS have all the logic to like implement SSH or show the prompt, login prompt on the screen. We can have just a program do that, and we can replace those programs easily without like changing the core of the OS. So one part of this that I've kind of skipped over, that's kind of intuitively important is, well, it has to check if the password is correct. How does that work? Because we haven't actually talked about passwords. And on a typical Unix-like system, the core part of the OS doesn't know anything about passwords. It's just these programs that are running as the system administrator that know about it. So what we do for that is, well, the most common scheme on a single user system is that there's a special file that contains the password information. It's typically called /etc/shadow. And it's just set up to have permissions, so it's owned by user ID 0 and only readable or writable by user ID 0. So any programs not set up by the system administrator shouldn't be able to access it. On the department machines, you know, we have accounts, you know, shared among multiple machines. So the login program actually contacts the network service to check your password. And we can use cryptography, what we're going to talk about later. And kind of an advantage of this scheme just being implemented as normal program code is that it's actually very easy to say, I don't want to use passwords anymore. I want to use tokens or fingerprints or something. That's easy to do. We aren't actually changing much of the OS to do that. Okay. So another part of what this program is doing is it's changing user IDs. So there's a call to do that. There's a library call which makes a request to the OS to change user IDs. You could call it. It just won't work for you because it only works if your user ID is 0 to start with, basically. Yeah?
So theoretically, if you wanted to like transfer super user access to another user, is that like possible in this setup?
So the question is, how can I transfer super user access to another user? Because it seems like once I do the set UID thing, I'm giving up the ability to change UIDs back to anything else. So that's a good question, and there's a special mechanism to support that. Yeah, we'll talk about that next. Yeah?
You said if you start with user ID 0, if you like escalate privileges to root, are you able to then use like change it, or do you have to be root on
that? Question, if you escalate privileges to root, can you change it? So if your user ID 0, you can change it, and being root is being user ID 0. They're the same thing. Yeah.
If you're the super user and can I change like my own user ID to be not 0?
So question, if I'm the super user, I can change my own user ID to be not 0? Yes. And at that point, you are no longer a super user. So basically what this login program might be doing is that once it figures out you should log in, it gives up all its special super user permissions by making this call to set UID. So it's not super user anymore. And typically part of why it still works is that it will start a new process, a new instance of a program to do this. So when you exit, it will still have its old instance running and that will prompt for the next user. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay, so yeah, so someone brought up, wait a moment, so if this gives up permissions entirely, how do I like transfer super user? How do I get to be different users? And you may have seen a mechanism like this if you use virtual machines or administered a Linux machine or possibly even a Mac machine of the sudo command. So the sudo command is a command that commonly will let me specify something to run as user ID 0. And if I'm in a list of authorized users, it will check my password and then run it as user ID 0. And you might say, how does that work? Because when I run programs as my user ID, which is not 0, and I type, they can't change their user ID to 0 because we can't just let any program change its user ID to 0. What's special about sudo? And the answer is that there's some metadata that's on the sudo executables file. So the file for the sudo program is marked with a special bit called the set user ID bit. And if set, the sort of execute program request to the OS changes the effective user ID to the owner of that file. So basically, the system administrator has set up the sudo program, so when anyone runs it, it runs as super user. And because it runs as super user, it has permissions to check passwords, to read those password databases, to change user IDs to whatever it wants. And this is, in fact, a setting you can set with chmod if you're allowed to have set user ID programs. And sudo basically has code where it like says, oh, is the original user who ran me allowed to do this? If so, do it. Otherwise, print an error and exit. Yes? Sorry, how would this?
How would this be different
from kernel mode? From what? How is this different from kernel mode? So the sudo program is still making a request of the OS. And this is generally true for super user. It's just that the OS is going to say yes to those requests. But it still has to go through the OS, and that OS code could be written to not allow super user to do certain things. Does that answer your question? Yeah?
So it changes it to the owner. Does that necessarily mean it changes
So the question, if it changes to the owner, does that mean it changes to the super user over time? So for sudo, it's going to be have its owner be user ID 0. If it wasn't user ID 0, it would change it to some other user. But usually you'll find set UID programs are owned by user ID 0 because that's the most useful user ID to change to. Does that answer your question? Yes, back there. What is chmod u plus s? This sets the, this, you know, marks an executable as set user ID. So it requests that when you run this executable, that the system change to the owner of a, change effective user ID to the owner of the executable. Yeah.
Why is it considered a permission, or is this using the modification in a different way?
Question, why is it considered permission? Like, why is it part of chmod? So chmod, it sets these mode bits, and it turns out that the mode bits, if we think of an octal number, we have some permission bits, we have these some extra flags, which include this set user ID bit, and we have some type info. And chmod is for setting all of these sort of the flags and the permission bits, but they're stored together on sort of the in the Unix design. They don't have to be, but that's just what they chose historically. Yeah. Can the OS reject permissions for someone using sudo? So the way the sudo program works, if the OS is running it as user ID 0, the sudo program is making those decisions, coding them. Now, the OS might not, for sudo to like work this way, it has to have been set up with that set user ID bit set, and the OS is not just going to let anyone do that and anyone have files owned by user ID 0. Does that answer your question? And set user ID programs actually come up a lot if we're thinking about using a typical Linux system. So like mounting a USB stick is generally done with a set user ID program because there's stuff that, because we don't want to give all programs access to the functions to manipulate what files are available, because it would be really bad if I used that to like break people's home directories. But if we want you to allow you to, you know, plug a USB stick into a potentially shared machine, we'll have a set user ID program which handles doing that and calls these things that, you know, if we're calling them not on the USB stick, would be really bad. You know, similarly for like accessing monitors and stuff. So I've described how set user ID programs work. I'd like to mention that you shouldn't write them. So sudo is a set user ID program, like seems useful, and it's a fairly simple process to have one. You have something owned by super users, so if you're the system administrator, this is relatively easy to do. You can get access to change the owner to root, user ID 0. But if you try to write a set user ID program, it's probably going to be insecure. And the reason for this is that people can run your program in all sorts of strange ways. And this has been a problem for like sudo and other programs like that. So famously, sudo has had lots of very subtle bugs, which are based on running sudo like 10,000 times until the random numbers work out, and with like variables set in weird ways just to trigger that exactly right. Your program needs to be super bug-free for that to be safe, and it's practice hard for people to happen. That's kind of a very big disadvantage of this kind of scheme for letting you have individual programs run with sudo. So we've talked about these permissions, and next time we're going to talk sort of more about the implementation of this. So we've kind of given you the impression that to do certain things on the system, you need to make requests to the OS. You know, so like you shouldn't be able to read other files, and we've talked about how we specify who can do that, but we haven't talked about like what about the system is keeping you from just directly accessing the hard drive with the files. Why can't you do that? And we're going to talk about that, and that's going to be related to kernel mode and how that core part of the OS works.